Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Don Howard, former director and fellow of the University of Notre Dame's Riley Center for Science, Technology, and Values, where he now functions as co-director of the Center's Ethics of Emerging Technologies focus area. He's also a fellow of the American Physical Society, past chair of APS's Forum on the History of Physics, and the APS Committee on International Freedom of Scientists, an internationally recognized expert on the history and philosophy of modern physics, especially the work of Einstein and Bohr, and has published many books and articles in history and philosophy of science, as well as the ethics of technology. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I wanted to ask you, I know this is you know, many years of work, but I thought I could ask maybe one brief question about your work on Einstein and the implications of Einstein's work for philosophy of science, perhaps this idea of the role of conventions versus Kantian a priori concepts. If you could just tell us a tiny little bit about that.
Indeed. Well, this is something I work a lot on.
Yeah.
I've published tons on this issue. One of my missions is to make it better known to both my philosophy colleagues and my physicist colleagues that Einstein was not only arguably the greatest physicist of the 20th century, but also one of the most thoughtful and impactful philosophers of science of at least the early 20th century.
Yeah.
His own ideas and the theories that he developed had a major impact on the way in which philosophy of science learned to theorize such questions as what is the empirical grounding for advanced theoretical physics?
Yeah.
I'm also fascinated by the fact that Einstein stood out even in his own day, but less so than today, by way of his really extensive training in the history and philosophy of science, his wide-ranging reading in the history and philosophy of science, and the difference that that made in the way he did his physics.
Yeah.
And he wrote about this on multiple occasions, and he made the following really interesting argument as the core argument. What difference does a training in history and philosophy of science make in the work of the physicist? And what he said was, it's training in history and philosophy of science that gives the physicist independence of judgment that enables the physicist to do the kind of thing that Einstein did as that young rebel in 1905 and say, yes, there's tons of evidence that support classical mechanics and classical electrodynamics, but gee, maybe it's not really the only way to do physics, and there's this tantalizing evidence that suggests there's this problem and this problem and this problem with classical physics. And you know, then he found the sort of moral intellectual courage to go against tradition.
Wow.
And again, that's what he said was the chief value of that training.
Wow.
He said this is what distinguishes, that this independence of judgment encouraged by history and philosophy of science is the distinguishing mark of the genuine, quote, seeker after truth.
Yeah.
And I think those are important words. Today we find ourselves locked into debates about whether or not fundamental physics, the Standard Model, and so forth, has sort of run out of steam. We discovered the Higgs boson. It was the last thing we needed to confirm with regard to the Standard Model.
Yeah.
But now the Large Hadron Collider hasn't produced any new physics beyond the energy level where we found that. Anxiety is growing in the physics community about whether or not this project of a theoretical understanding of nature at its foundations is petering out. We're at a moment in history where a growing number of physicists are starting to ask the same kinds of questions that Einstein asked at the beginning of the 20th century, such as my good friend, the expert on quantum gravity, Carlo Rovelli. And they are not only asking whether we need new directions, but they are also, interestingly, saying, And we need to draw the philosophers into this conversation.
Wow, wow. I was also curious in your own work, in your own career. I believe your undergraduate degree was in physics, and I wanted to ask you how you found your way into philosophy from physics, or if that's how it went.
So both interests were of ancient vintage.
Okay.
I was a real nerd in junior high school.
Okay.
And I was already reading a lot of philosophy and making myself self-taught in physics. And I vividly remember the required conversation in eighth grade with the guidance counselor, where we were supposed to tell her what we wanted to be when we grew up. And I said to her, yeah, tough question. I think I want to be either a physicist or a philosopher. And of course, the eighth grade guidance counselor had no advice to offer either point.
Yeah.
Here I am, 70 years old, nearing the end of my career, and I'm still suspended between these two desires.
Right.
I live in both of those professional worlds. I publish in both of those professional settings. But yes, when I went to college, I made the decision to major in physics. But I had the great good fortune, this was at Michigan State University, 1967, I had the great good fortune to begin my studies there as a member of the inaugural class of a residential science studies college called Lyman Briggs College that had required work in the history and philosophy of science as a built-in part of the curriculum. So this was the perfect place for someone with my interest. I also had the good fortune to take my very first undergraduate physics course at Michigan State with a physicist who was unusual at that time, and unusual even today. His name is Richard Schlegel, a physicist who had a very serious and sophisticated interest in the philosophy of science and published books in the philosophy of science. So I didn't know how unusual that was at the time. But I was benefited enormously by that. As I got further into my studies, however, it became progressively clearer to me that the kinds of interests, the kinds of questions that first drew me into physics were probably not going to be answered for me in a PhD program in physics. Uh-huh. I did do 1 year in a PhD program in physics, but that sort of sealed the deal for me, where I realized that the really deep foundational questions and the really deep conceptual questions weren't what my physics teachers were talking about. And I learned about the existence of this field called the philosophy of physics.
Okay.
And I decided that's where I really had to be, given the kinds of issues that I was interested in.
Wow.
So I got myself into what was at the time the very best place to do philosophy of physics, Boston University, where one of the many things special about that place at the time is that three of my philosophy faculty members at Boston University had cross appointments in the physics department.
Wow.
That was unheard of at the time, that's still unheard of today, but yet again, this accident of circumstance created an environment that for me was just the perfect environment to nurture those interests in philosophy of physics. So I was blessed. I was really fortunate to just sort of stumble into these unusual settings that I found intellectually wonderful and really stimulating.
You mentioned a minute ago, I believe you mentioned Carlo Rovelli, and I wanted to ask if aside from that, in general these days, are there other physicists that you would point to who are conscious of and interested in philosophy in this way, or are there certain cases that you would cite where scientists are really truly engaged with philosophy and it's fruitful?
Well, the good news is that the number of physicists who are seriously interested in philosophy and history and in working collaboratively with philosophers and historians of physics, the number of physicists who show those interests are growing steadily. And this is the case all around the world. So let me tell you about one endeavor that I've been part of for more than 20 years now. I was a founding member of the board for what's called the Seven Pines Symposium. This is an annual event every May in a small lodge outside of Stillwater, Minnesota, affiliated with the University of Minnesota Physics Department and History of Science program, where what we do every year is we pick a topic that is at the cutting edge of new developments in physics, but all different fields in physics. And then we assemble a group, a core group of about 20 to 25 mainly physicists, but a goodly number of philosophers, historians. Sometimes we invite in biologists or mathematicians, you know, whatever the topic demands. We lock them into this country lodge for 4 days, and we sit them around a big table, and the whole point of the exercise is to just have this rich interdisciplinary conversation about the issues that have been chosen for that year. We invite presentations, but we tell the presenters that you have to keep them really short, no more than 30 minutes max, and you're not supposed to be reporting on the latest fruits of your own research. Instead, you're supposed to be giving a kind of pedagogical introduction to the specific set of questions we've asked you to talk about. Then we open up the floor for discussion that will sometimes run for a full 2 hours. These are incredible events. I've learned so much from them. The physicists who have taken part in these events go away just ecstatic about how much they have enjoyed enjoyed this. We have had, and the cachet that's developed around this is such that on more than one occasion, we have had sometimes prominent physicists, in one special case, a very famous Nobel Prize winning physicist who got in touch with the director because he was really angry that he hadn't been invited to this meeting. Why he hadn't been invited is that given the nature of the exercise, we want to make sure that people are not only smart, but they know how to get along with one another. So you don't want big egos.
Sure, right.
And this is somebody who had a huge ego.
Okay.
And he proved the point by the very fact that he wrote this really angry note. But that told us a lot about how the larger community looked at this exercise.
Yeah.
And some of the core members of the board are really prominent physicists. So the University of Chicago general relativist, Bob Wald, who's a member of the National Academy of Sciences, he's long been part of the board. He's a mainstay at these meetings.
Yeah.
Or the University of British Columbia physicist, Philip Stamp. He's a condensed matter theorist. Long been a part of the board. His UBC colleague, Bill Unruh, who's one of these people who has an effect named after him, it's called the Unruh effect, which is really, really cool. He's long been a member of the board. And these guys just eat this stuff up, and they have grown in philosophical sophistication to the point where I have invited them to then be parts of symposia at philosophy of science meetings, and that's gone very, very well. So this is still not the norm in the physics community, but again, as I say, the good news is that more and more of my physics colleagues are eager to engage this. Just one more anecdote on this point. At Notre Dame, we have really good working relationships between the philosophers and the physicists, to the point where for many years we have jointly, that is physics department, philosophy department, offered an undergraduate course on the philosophy of physics that can be taken for credit toward the major in both departments. And that's hugely popular among our students, especially the physics students. A lot of engineering students come to that course as well. But that's just another bit of anecdotal evidence about how there are a growing number of spaces within which this kind of constructive collaboration is flourishing.
That's fantastic. I can imagine what it must be like just sitting around that table with all those people.
Also, there's a really good bar.
Okay.
In the lodge.
Also important.
And that really helps too.
I bet. I wanted to ask about in the area of technology and ethics, which was the subject of your talk and a lot of your recent work. There was this case in the news just a few weeks ago about the question of of Department of Defense contracts and high-tech companies. And the story, as I recall, was that I think Google had had employees protest against contracting with Department of Defense, and they thought that the ethical thing to do was to not do this. But then in contrast, I believe, I think Microsoft and Oracle or so forth said, no, we believe that the right thing to do is to do this. And I wanted to ask about your interpretation. It seems like, you know, that these different companies or communities appear to be reflecting and coming to these different conclusions on what's the right thing to do. And I wondered if you had already commented on that. Or
well, yeah, this was a noteworthy event. And the term employee revolt has now become entrenched in the discourse about this to describe mainly what happened at Google in the episode that you're recalling, where not only was there a lot of pushback just within the company, there were a significant number of people who resigned from Google because they were so upset at the way Google was behaving here. How to explain the different responses of Google and some of the other major tech firms, you mentioned Microsoft. Yeah. Well, remember that when Google was born, a famous part of the Google ethos was do no harm. And that was just deeply ingrained in the self-understanding of how Google was supposed to be a different kind of corporate actor.
Right.
So a lot of people who were drawn to work at Google were drawn because that was part of the corporate ethos.
Right.
And so they especially felt a sense of betrayal when they then saw the company doing things that they regarded as morally problematic. Whereas that was never such a prominent part of the ethos at Microsoft.
Right.
And so that's part of the explanation for why these two different communities responded in different ways.
When you cited that, it made me think of earlier you're discussing the whole field of the trolley problems and so forth. And I thought, oh, that sounds like, you know, don't be evil. It's like, that's when you don't want to put your hand on the lever. You don't want to get involved. You know any movement of that lever will do something. Will kill someone. And so if you're just not involved, it sounds like that is a little bit like what the Google employees are thinking.
Yeah, and the problem there, by the way, and that's part of the background to this dust up at Google, is that not acting can also many times translate into doing evil by omission. Or inattention. That's something that actors in this tech space need to be a lot more alert to. It's not just enough to avoid deliberately doing something harmful. It's also really important to be reflective about whether or not what you're doing just in the ordinary course of business without intending harm, whether that might wind up producing harm. And there are lots of examples of technologies that have had impacts of that kind.
In your talk and in your recent papers and so forth, you've used this approach of virtue ethics, talking about civic virtue, and that's in contrast to the utilitarian or the kind of Kantian approach to ethics. And I wondered if the kind of school of thought of virtue ethics, is that widely recognized among technologists, or is it still sort of less familiar to people than the kind of rule-based approach?
So it depends on the community that you're talking about. Among my philosophy colleagues, the virtue ethics tradition is widely discussed. It's one of the major alternatives in the philosophical literature, and has been such since the revival of interest in virtue ethics in the early 1980s, thanks to this wonderful book by my Notre Dame colleague, Alastair MacIntyre, called After Virtue. But in the tech sector, among engineers, it's much, much less well-known point of view than utilitarianism or Kantian rule-based deontology. So part of my mission, if you will, is to help make this framework better known within technical communities, and to engage them in conversations about how more awareness of the distinctive features of the virtue ethics tradition might help inform the decision making of the engineers and CEOs and so forth.
I was a little curious too about kind of the history of that, or how is it that, I mean, obviously, you know, the virtue of being having this ancient tradition, how is it that it sort of went into eclipse until McIntyre, and you know, why did it sort of lose ground, if it did for a while, to these other approaches?
That's a very good question, and the short answer to that is that it's all tied up with the history of the Enlightenment.
Okay.
And so virtue ethics was a way of thinking that retained a lot of vigor well up into you know, the 17th century.
Right.
But with the Enlightenment, the general tenor of people's thinking about moral choice shifted. And so Kant, who's the father of the deontological approach, is, of course, at the same time, one of the most important theorists of the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
And John Stuart Mill, who's one of the most important proponents of the utilitarian or consequentialist tradition,
right,
was also, at the same time, one of the most important theorists of the Enlightenment in the specific form that that took in liberal political theory in the middle part of the 19th century.
Yeah.
So the waning of interest in the virtue ethics tradition is largely a function of the emergence of the Enlightenment. And bear in mind that since virtue ethics had been very strongly associated with Catholic moral philosophy,
right,
in the Middle Ages and beyond, for that reason also come the Enlightenment and the sort of anti-religious,
right,
secular turn that is characteristic of the Enlightenment in some of its forms, that association with Catholic intellectual tradition,
yeah,
worked against virtue ethics. Why did that begin to change in the middle and latter part of the 20th century? It's because a lot of new literature and a lot of new thinking began to emerge in the post-war period, and even more so in like the post-Vietnam War period, that began asking really tough critical questions about the Enlightenment and the kind of political work and that the Enlightenment had in fact produced.
Right.
And so thinkers at that time started to ask, well, are there other traditions that we might return to,
yeah,
that would give us a different toolkit for thinking about the challenges of the day, in ways that might, in some settings, be better than deontology and consequentialism.
Okay.
And so that's a short version,
yeah,
of why,
yeah,
it waned, and then it came charging back in the latter, okay, part of the 20th century.
Thank you. And kind of maybe a sort of follow-up is, in your talk, and I believe your discussion of Shannon Ballard and her work in this field, this idea that that there's multiple traditions of virtue ethics, Confucian, Buddhist, mm-hmm, as well as Aristotelian, and so forth, and you alluded to this debate about whether it can be pluralistic, which is a strength, or do its critics say that it's relativist, which would be a weakness, I guess. And so I guess I would ask this question of, well, how does a certain community come to adopt a certain framework or a certain set of virtues as normative or as their set of virtues? Is it about tradition, or sort of where does it come from in that sense?
Well, tradition plays a large part. Sometimes it's more deliberate normative formations than that. In general, the way this is theorized in the virtue ethics tradition is that you look at a community of practice,
right,
and you ask the question, what are the goods toward which the activity of the members of that community of practice should be oriented?
Right.
And then the decision about what are the specific virtues local to that community of practice is derivative from that vision of the good.
Yeah.
And so that's the first question you ask is, you know, for this community, what are we mainly trying to do?
Right.
What does human flourishing look like in this kind of a community?
Yeah.
And then you sort out what are the virtues that are appropriate to that. And yes, of course, there is the legitimate worry that if there's no way of norming the discourse about the ends, then individual communities could, to use an expression I was using in a discussion a few minutes ago, might go rogue, start behaving in ways that are seriously questionable, requiring an intervention from the outside. But to the question, what in general is the impediment to the slide into radical relativism? Well, there are a couple of things to say here. One is the very important point that all of us are always members of multiple communities.
Right.
And so in our different roles as an art historian and a philosopher of physics, there might be domain-specific kinds of intellectual virtues that are more important in art history than they are in the philosophy of physics. But at the same time, we're both members of a larger academic community where there are obviously all sorts of shared norms and shared values and shared virtues.
Yeah.
And so that multiple and layered and overlapping structure of community membership is a very powerful check against the slide into radical relativism.
Right.
The other point that I would make is that if we back out and sort of take a global perspective on this, because of course we need to think about this from the point of view of cultural difference in the large and religious difference and
national
difference and difference in economic class and so forth. What at that level of description are the factors that will function as checks against the slide into radical relativism. And one important answer to that question is that we all share a similar biological heritage.
Right.
We all share common environmental challenges.
Yeah.
You know, we have to clothe ourselves, feed ourselves, nurture our children. It's part of our biological heritage that we all grieve the loss of a loved one in broadly similar ways. Whatever might be some of the other differences that divide us dramatically, we can always find a common ground when we go to those places that are universal parts of the human experience.
Yeah.
So that's the other factor that I think is the main check against the slide into radical relativism.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Well, you've some of these really interesting recent papers that you've published and which you mentioned in your talk. You've written about autonomous weapons, self-driving cars, robots, and robot ethics, and so forth. Let me just ask. Well, if you could maybe tell us a little bit about what you're currently working on and kind of your current projects.
Oh, well, currently I'm working on a number of projects. So this, I have this ongoing project on ethics programming for autonomous systems.
Okay.
So that's a continuing, serious, significant engagement of mine. I continue to think a lot about the autonomous weapons issues.
Yeah.
I just signed on the other day to be part of a panel at a big conference, a big international conference at Purdue in May.
Yeah.
That is going to be majorly focused on these issues about autonomous weapon systems. And I think about a lot of other questions as well. One that I think about a lot, though I've only once published on this, and this was only an op-ed a year or so ago, I think a lot about the problem of technological unemployment, which in my opinion is the single biggest ethical challenge in this whole space of tech ethics. Short version is that as the bots get better and the AI gets better, more and more jobs that have been done heretofore by humans are going to be done by the robots and the AI. That presents us with a huge social ethics problem. We're throwing more and more thousands of people out of work. And how is that going to change society? How is that going to impact their lives. I think this is a compelling moral challenge. I don't think the global community or our nation is doing enough yet to think about this problem. There are ideas out there. One idea that you hear espoused, curiously and interestingly, by a lot of the leaders in Silicon Valley is the idea of a universal basic income. Part of the gain of the introduction of robotics and AI is that productivity gains have gone up. The rate of increase in productivity in our economy has been really impressive, and a lot of that is a product of technical innovation. Of course, the other side of this is that it's the very same technical innovation that's throwing people out of work. But the point is that with those impressive productivity gains, we are generating so much more wealth. And let's just talk about the U.S. economy. So that a back of the envelope calculation shows that actually it wouldn't be that much of a strain on the U.S. economy to build out existing programs like Medicare and Social Security and so forth into something that looked like a universal basic income program. And at least that might be a way of providing a kind of an economic foundation for everyone. Of course, on the other hand, universal basic income might bring with it some problems that we have to think about. So forget about the worry of some people that it's a form of socialism. Think instead about problems like this. If we provide a universal basic income for everyone, enough to put a roof over your head, food on the table, provide transportation, education, you know, all those basic human needs, what's the risk that we're all just going to become lazy bums? You know, I think that's a real concern. If I am not compelled by economic necessity to work for a living, what kind of person will I turn into in that kind of a world? Or think about it from this perspective. I think that human identity and human self-understanding is intimately bound up with the work that we do. When we meet one another at a cocktail party, we introduce ourselves to one another. What's one of the first things we do? We say, "Hi, I'm Joe," and "Hi, I'm Bill." And then the very first question is, "Bill, what do you
what
do?"
What do you do?
And I mean, isn't it interesting that that's where we go first? We don't say, "Where did you come from?" You know, we don't say, "Tell me about your kids." You know, we start with, "Well, what do you do for a living?" If that's gone, if I no longer have to work for a living, and I no longer define myself around the work that I do, what will be the psychological impact on me from living in a setting like that? I don't have answers to those questions, but I worry a lot about those questions. And this is an area I want to be more active in future, is helping us to think through that challenge.
Really, really serious question. Well, this is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and our guest today is Don Howard. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you again, Ben. I've enjoyed this very, very much.
Don Howard's visit to UT Dallas was sponsored by the Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology, and our podcast is produced by Creative Disturbance. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.